You're rolling great. Do we need to clap? No, there's no video. This is great.
Oh my God. I don't know how to deal with the fact that there's no video.
Hello, everyone. Chris Chappell here with
Shelly Zhang.
And we are doing our very first ever podcast. Round of applause. We got some great talks that we're going to talk at you. So get ready to be talked at.
Oh my God. I'm so nervous. Okay.
You're going to be great. I'm going to be better, though. So we did it. We're back from Australia and New Zealand. We did a lot of hard work and, you know, we're all pretty exhausted. So obviously we had the great idea to add more work to our plate and do podcasts. So, Shelly, what was the most fun you had on a shoot?
The most fun I've ever had on a shoot in Australia and or New Zealand probably was...
That sounds very formal. I'm just teasing you. Let your hair down. Let your beautiful blue hair down.
I have short hair. Okay. The most fun I've had was probably at the on the bush shoot, I think. We can edit some of this so that we take out all the
all
awkward.
All of this is gold.
No.
All of this is gold.
Okay.
No edits necessary. So yeah, what was the most fun you had in Australia or New Zealand?
Probably watching you eat a grub.
The grub was actually really delicious. It was just very oily and fatty. I was very happy we cooked it, though. At first, I thought I was going to have to eat a live grub, and I had a little bit of... I would have had an issue with that, I think.
I was actually expecting it to be a little more plump than it was. Like, you know, when you think of, like...
There could be some big grubs, but, you know, he's probably keeping... Jake probably kept the best grubs for himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we only got half of a possum.
Oh, okay. Which half was it?
Do you want to know?
Probably not.
Well, there we go.
You know, the thing about the possum that surprised me was that people were so upset.
Yeah, it's like we ate a kitten or something.
Yeah, like every time we told someone in Australia that we ate a possum, they were like, oh no, not the adorable little possums.
Yeah, it wasn't like from the perspective of, oh, that's gross, that's a horrible varmint. It was like, that's such a cute animal. I don't think anyone in the U.S. really feels possums are super cute.
No, but like, I guess we have cuter animals in America. Like, think about the animals in Australia. Like, possums are probably, like, okay, kangaroos are pretty cute. Koalas are cute, like, from 3 feet away, but then you see them up close and they're horrifying looking. And so, like, possums, I guess, are probably, like, better than platypuses? I don't know. What do you think?
On a continent that has the most poisonous, dangerous animals in the world, I guess, yeah, compared to all of that, possums are probably cute.
So what we should have eaten was a crocodile.
Well, we did have that crocodile pizza. Do you remember what that tasted like?
Fish.
It's like a chickeny fish. It's just as appetizing as it sounds. Yeah, we didn't really do a good job eating in Australia. We had Subway and McDonald's.
And Domino's Pizza.
Domino's Pizza. Good decisions.
All of this fine Australian cuisine.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I feel like this is where we're going to get angry, like, emails.
Do you think people really love Domino's?
No, I think they're going to be upset that we went to Australia and then judged all of their food by bad Domino's pizza.
Oh, I'm not judging Australia's food. I'm just saying we made bad food decisions constantly. Could you survive in the bush, Shelley, if you had to?
Absolutely not. I was actually thinking earlier today that I need to learn some basic survival skills. Like, I would just, you know, like, you know, some people like to think that, like, oh, like, wouldn't it be great if we lived in, like, Game of Thrones or something like that?
No one says they wish they lived in Game of Thrones.
Or, you know, like, even Lord of the Rings, right? Like, oh, you know.
In the idyllic pastoral past.
Yeah, we'd all be dead.
We would all be dead. I mean, not me, because I learned from Jake how to survive. I can make a fire. Totally.
Can you make a fire?
I haven't tried since you showed me, but I'm sure I could.
Uh-huh. What else can you do now?
I know that one type of berry I can eat.
Okay.
If I can eat a possum if somebody brought it to me cooked.
Pre-roasted.
Pre-roasted.
Yes. Let's see, what else did you learn? You can read Egyptian hieroglyphics now?
I was never able to read them.
Okay. I was trying to give you something, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it was a nice down from the many, many late nights of working into the wee hours writing scripts for the next day.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, I think...
It was no vacation.
No, I think because, you know, you'd have to, like, do something during the day. Like, we'd shoot an interview or something, but then we'd get back from that and then immediately have to keep working on, like, the Sydney Institute speech or, you know, planning for the next day's shoot, things like that. And for some of these things, it's hard to do them ahead of time.
Yeah, because things are always coming up.
So we'd be, you know, like, late into the night trying to come up with, like, ideas for the next day's, like, shoot. So
while fueling ourselves on Subway and Domino's.
Yeah, that's why, like, you know, or, like, when we were in Canberra and we were like, all right, we need to do something with the, you know, Chinese students and, like, the CSSAs, and what would be a good way to explain this? And, you know, at 11 p.m., we're like, ah, yes, we could talk about academic freedom like it's a drug.
Oh, like Animal House or a fraternity kind of movie thing.
Yeah, and then we're like, oh, crap, now we need to go buy a sheet at Target.
To make a toga. And, yeah, that's like, okay, it's... It's now midnight. We have the shoot the next day. Where do we get a toga?
I have to say that, like, Alex Drosky was, like, a good sport when we were like, by the way, toga.
Yeah, Alex Drosky was a really great sport. I mean, you know, when we go to him, it's like, you know, this is a very serious, important topic that we want to discuss with you. By the way, I'll be wearing a toga.
You know, we understand that, you know, you've been researching this issue for years now, but... Could you, you know, pretend that the CSSA is like a frat?
When you put it that way, are we terrible people, Shelley?
We are awful people.
Yeah. I was amazed, though, that, you know, we were just able to kind of, like, shoot on the campus. Like, I feel like in a U.S. university, it would have been impossible.
Oh, yeah. They would be like, do you have a bomb under that toga? I don't know. Not that, but you know what I mean? Like, the campus security? Yeah. Like, in my university, you had to, like, swipe your pass to even get into the library. And we were, like, walking in and out of the library multiple times, like, right in front of their security people. Nobody said anything.
I couldn't believe, though, when we were interviewing Chinese students, just the few of them that didn't know what democracy was.
I think, like, okay, it was definitely partially the language barrier, because there are two girls that, like, they, when they eventually, like, realized that democracy is Mingzhu,
yeah,
like, then I was like, in retrospect, I was like, maybe we should have had to use the Chinese word.
Well, no, because, like, I'm sure they would have some definition of Mingzhu, but the point is, like, they're studying in an Australian university. Like, part of the reason this is, like, said to be a good thing is because it allows these Chinese students to see another way of life, to see Western democracy. But if they can't even have the basic language skills to know what the word democracy is, that's a huge failure.
Of the Western university system, or...
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, mainly that, because they've become so desperate for the money that these Chinese students are bringing, that they're willing to lower the standards to the point where some of these students barely speak a word of English, let alone democracy.
I do wonder how they get along in class, because...
Well, Alex was saying that that's the problem. They don't have the skills to communicate with other students, so they end up in these bubbles of just Chinese students, and they stay in these bubbles, and they don't have a positive university experience.
Yeah, I was, like, reading this article about how, like, there's a lot of fraud going on with the applications.
Oh, I bet.
So, like, that people, like, other people are writing the essays for some of these students, or they're, like, basically, like, companies that will do this for you.
Shelley, I thought of a great way we can make money for the show.
You laugh, but somebody suggested this to me once.
Really?
Not the fraud part, but like suggested like
Have you ever considered fraud as a way to make money?
Not that part, but just like the maybe there's like a way to like, you know, like tap into the Chinese student market. Like, but I don't think they were not suggesting that we fake people's grades and whatever that goes on. I'm not saying that, but.
And we wouldn't, right? Yeah, I wouldn't. No, totally not. Okay. So what was it like meeting fans? We had a fan meetup in Australia and New Zealand.
What's it like for you meeting fans?
Oh, man, it's awesome. They like me.
Oh, Chris.
I'm a simple person.
deep down, there's just the soft part hidden underneath all that suit.
Somewhere. Deep down. One fan gave us a big chocolate Easter egg. Like, it was huge.
He gave you a big chocolate Easter egg.
Oh, I assumed it was for all of us, even though I ate it myself.
I thought we were going to have trouble smuggling it back.
Through border control?
Through customs.
Oh, that's a nightmare. But yeah, I mean, the fans were great. Like, it's amazing to see, like, the big range of fans of the show we have. Like, you know, there was like a couple of 10-year-old kids, and then on the other end, there were, you know, people in their 50s who have been like China watchers for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do we span that demographic?
I thought it was really cute, the 10-year-old kid who met you and then was like, it's even better than I imagined.
Yes. That was very sweet. And he was watching China Uncensored, like, in front of me on the phone. That's
how did that feel?
It's like, I don't know if I would have made that decision if I were in his shoes, but...
How does it feel to know that you are a role model?
I better clean up my act.
Mm-hmm.
It is... We might be getting to that soft part under the suit, Shelley.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like quite a responsibility. Like, I feel like I want to, you know, make sure I give something back to all these people who, like, really care about the show.
And what is that that you can give back?
Well, this podcast, for instance.
Good answer.
Thank you. I hope anyone listens to this. My mom will.
Yeah, I was going to say, at least your parents will.
Yes. Two views, listens.
Your parents are fans of the show, right?
Well, they're fans of me.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically the same thing.
Okay. I do find it pretty cute when, like, sometimes you, like, tell me that your mom said something, like, passes a message along, like, to me.
Oh, yeah.
From the show. Like...
Well, my parents are also fans of Shelley as well. So what killed me is, you know, everything that's happening in Australia with the Chinese Communist Party's infiltration of, you know, politics and society, it's huge breaking news. And, like, this was one of the biggest stories for a while. And then we go to Australia, and we're doing all these great topics. And that month, there has to be so many huge breaking China stories. Kim Jong-un visited Chinese leader Xi Jinping for the first time. And, like, they didn't even think to ask how that fits into our schedule.
Yeah, the whole time I was thinking, which animal in the 100-acre wood is Kim Jong-un?
We still haven't come up with an answer to that, so if anyone has any suggestions...
Yeah, it's pretty hard. I mean, Xi Jinping's already Winnie the Pooh, so...
That's kind of taken. So what were your impressions of Australia? What was it like to go on this really big trip for the show?
Exhausting. Did we use the word exhausting?
We can use exhausting as much as we want.
Okay, exhausting. And I was actually really kind of impressed with Australia. Like, I felt like people were really into the topic that we were talking about. Like,
yeah.
Because doing China Uncensored in America is kind of like, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's a very niche thing to be talking about. And in Australia, it's different because it's big news. Yeah. So,
and we were talking to a lot of people face to face, which we usually don't do when we're just in the studio. So we got to...
That's
see
true.
The impact of our good deeds.
Well, talk about that. How did it feel for you to do something like a speech at the Sydney Institute?
Oh, man. The Sydney Institute was actually, I was super nervous for that because I've never really written a half hour long speech. So I had no idea. how much time I needed to write something like that, how long it needed to be. And so it wasn't like the draft had like 99 pages of notes or something, right?
It was like 40 pages.
99 sounds better.
Okay.
We'll cut that out, your other number. You know, fortunately, like after I got a couple of drafts written, you know, you were able to help me out a lot. And I think we kind of got a pretty good speech written out.
I feel like the first half of our trip was like things we were doing and then also the speech. Like every time, like every time we got back from a shoot, you and I would be working on the speech. It was interesting also for me because I did not understand what the Sydney Institute was. Like,
I don't
was
think
like,
any of us really did.
Right? So I was like, oh, there's a place that, you know, somebody suggest, a fan of the show suggested that Chris speak at the Sydney Institute. And then, like, he helped arrange it. And we were like, oh, cool. Chris has a speech somewhere. But,
then
like,
when we started telling people in Australia,
then they were like, oh, you're speaking at the Sydney Institute. And we were like, yeah.
It's a really big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know what you would compare it to in the U.S. Like,
Book of the Month? Probably not.
Well, like, maybe like speaking at the Harvard Club or something like that.
And but so that really helped me, you know, relax and not be nervous.
But how did you feel after?
Oh, I felt great. I mean, the audience was pretty responsive for, you know, perhaps a more academic crowd. They lightly chuckled at a lot of the jokes, of the jokes.
That's like, that's killing when somebody chuckled slightly at the,
Well, fortunately, they were serving wine beforehand, so I think some of them were a little loosened up.
Uh-huh. Well, you probably were the first satirical news anchor to come speak at the Sydney Institute.
With a show based in New York that talks about China.
Yes, definitely. That's true. I think we can say that with confidence.
I hope so. If it turns out there is one other person like that, we might have to kill them.
I'm imagining him like your evil twin with a goatee.
How do you know I'm not the evil twin?
Oh, I guess that makes you shave for each show?
That's true. Every day shaving. What a nightmare. So what did you learn on the trip? Were you changed? Transformed?
I guess what really struck me was, especially in Australia, like the stories that people told that kind of, they all matched up, but they all seemed like conspiracy theories. And like when we were talking to the Chinese, like dissidents or the people in the Chinese community who like knew about how the Communist Party was infiltrating like Chinese Australian community and things like that, and they'd repeatedly say the same things about, you know, people being threatened to, like, you know, their visas being denied to travel back to China if they said anything. Those types of, like mafia-esque tactics.
But while we were there, there was the story that broke about how sometimes these overseas Chinese are kidnapped.
That was crazy, too, because Chen Yongling, who was one of the people we interviewed, the guy who defected from the Chinese consulate, he said that, you know, back in 2005 when he defected, he told the story about somebody who was kidnapped in Australia. And at the time, people were like, oh, that seems way
ridiculous.
That wouldn't happen. And like now there was like, an article in Foreign Policy that was talking about like, probably this is happening more often than we know. And like when we were there, John Hugh, another person we interviewed, he got denied entry into China after doing an interview with us. Not because of the interview with us, but
for previous activities that undermine the harmony of Chinese society.
Yeah. So hosting Clive Hamilton's book launch, for example.
That's like, right.
Yeah.
John Hugh hosted?
Well, the Australian Values Alliance.
Oh, John Hugh's organization.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was awful because, you know, he was going back home to China to bury his father and they denied him entry.
And then he had to leave his 80-year-old mother in Shanghai. Like, it's just kind of crazy the things that happen. And I remember him talking to us before he left where he was like, he knew some people and was trying to ask if he had been blacklisted and or if he would be able to go through, and he was like, yeah, they said to me like you're fine, so
yeah, no problem.
So it must have been something recent that he did.
Well, it probably wasn't us. You know, people always ask, like, do we ever get any kinds of harassment?
I mean, I haven't tried to apply for a visa to China.
No.
So, I don't know. I mean, I don't have a lot of hope since my dad was blacklisted in 2002.
Oh, the regime has changed after the economy has opened up. They're a democracy now, I'm pretty sure.
Actually, you know what's funny? Like, I think like part of the narrative about Xi Jinping being like this person who's come in and like implemented this dictatorship, mm-hmm. or like this kind of idea that like he is like tightening all the problem, like he's the one who's like
he's the next Mao.
Yeah, like I feel like
Kai.
A lot of things have become bad or worse, but things were bad before, and some things like it's just like I feel like instead of becoming worse, what they've actually become is more visible.
Yeah. I mean, they always were a regime that was harvesting organs from prisoners of conscience and kidnapping dissidents.
Yeah. Like, sometimes I think, like, some of the things we're seeing now that are actually getting reported by mainstream, like, media, like, about the situation happening with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang and the fact that there are these, like, crazy detention centers where people are just being sent for ideological education, like, so glad those stories are coming out. But honestly, it was happening like almost 20 years ago with the Falun Gong, and people weren't talking about it.
Yeah, it's strange how, well, we've seen, I guess what really surprised me being in Australia is seeing the level of influence of the Chinese Communist Party there and how they've been so successful at shaping the narrative there.
I think that's true, and it especially kind of shocked me that the politicians were talking about how, like, a lot of the stuff that was happening was kind of, like, on the back end, like, trying, like, Chinese consulate officials trying to influence the politicians in different ways, like, that MP Craig Kelly who talked about, like, somebody sitting next to him at a dinner and being like, don't see this show, Shen Yun, or the story that David Shoebridge had about, oh, and then we tried to have a panel discussion about organ harvesting, and they sent an email to all of the state-level MPs to, like, discourage them. Like, the Chinese consulate was, like, definitely directly interfering in Australia's political process and democratic institutions, but like nobody said anything about it.
Yeah, or even like Alex Joski, the student we interviewed at ANU, you know, he's been critical of Chinese Students and Scholar Associations, which are tied to the United Front, which is basically a branch of the Chinese Communist Party itself. And after he spoke up about these organizations, like they started following him around.
Like it's just amazing, or the kind of, or I'm thinking about that one guy who talked about Zhang Xiaogang, who was the pro-democracy movement activist who then came to Australia and tried to run in a local Australian election.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking like township level, like local election, and the consulate tried to like call the, you know, leader of the Unity Party that he was running under and trying to get them to stop having this candidate who had pro-democracy views on China. Like, it's, and I'm sure this is happening in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And other places. Like, we've heard isolated cases of, like, you know, like, even, like, city officials in the U.S., like, wanting to have a proclamation about human rights in China or whatever, and then getting harassed by the local consulate or embassy. But, like, it's just stunning, like, the pettiness that they'll go to, like, the level that they'll go to.
And it's so effective, too.
That's true.
So what surprised me is, you know, I'd say we were very, very successful in Australia. You know, we got to talk to a lot of dissidents and politicians, you know, give speeches. We were on TV. And then we went to New Zealand, and it was a very different situation.
Well, I mean, even before we went to New Zealand, we just could not get people who wanted to be interviewed.
No one wanted to talk to us.
From, you know, people who were pretty prominent China scholars in the field to just politicians. We couldn't get any MPs. Mm-hmm. And we had gotten MPs in Australia, but also, you know, Hong Kong and the Taiwan. U.S. and Taiwan. So it was just a pretty noticeable anomaly in New Zealand.
And a lot of the people we talked to in Australia felt that in New Zealand, people were trying to keep their heads down, which really was a shame to see.
Well, I think in a way I can understand because the population of the entire country is only a little over 4 million people.
Yeah, they have more sheep than they have people.
Way more sheep. But I think they feel a bit more cowed than Australia does. And I think also with Australia, the change has only really happened in the last year. With the scandals, with the Sam Dastyari and the other like political donations and ASIO coming out and saying that, like, you know, this is a major threat. But you'd think in New Zealand with like that thing with the MP Yang Jian, who ended up being...
Who used to train Chinese spies and right. Was the member of a communist party.
So it's just like that was kind of a scandal for like 2 weeks.
But he's still in office as far as we know.
I mean, you could feel the difference, I think, between Australia and New Zealand in that sense.
Yeah. I think it was best summed up by Alan, our camera guy, whenever we would drive past the giant herds of sheep and he would shout, "Open your eyes!" Speaking of those drives in New Zealand, we sure listened to a lot of the Lord of the Rings soundtrack.
I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to listen to the Lord of the Rings soundtrack now and only think of the movies. Now I think I'm going to be thinking of, like, you know, you dressed...
It's okay. We can talk about
that. Okay. I had this moment of, is this episode going to be out by the time we talk about this? But you walking around Hobbiton dressed as Elrond.
I was amazed that people don't really do that. Like, some of the staff there were saying people really don't cosplay all that often to Hobbiton.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, hobbits probably aren't the most, like, popular cosplay.
You'd have made a great hobbit, Shelley.
Yeah. Well, there were no Asian hobbits, so.
Whoa. What do you mean?
I mean, there were no Asian hobbits. The one thing that we did do in New Zealand was get on The Project, their current events entertainment show on Channel 3. So they wanted both of us to go on, and then they had a question that was about, like, xenophobia, whether, like, what we would say if people called our show, like, xenophobic, kind of, or...
Which they do.
Yeah. But then, of course, I had to field that question. So, like, the whole time we were doing this live 3-minute interview, I was just like, gotta nail the racism question.
That's, like, the ball was in your court for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of... like, how do you explain that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an issue that the Chinese Communist Party, to deflect any meaningful conversation about, you know, things like them kidnapping dissidents abroad, is to just say, oh, any criticism is racism. It's yellow peril. It's a Cold War mentality.
Yeah, that's true. But then from the other side, it's like, you know, we got to do things like we're pretty clear about the fact that we're talking about the Chinese Communist Party. Like, we try not to even say, like, China does this, China does that in the show, because we're not talking about the country of 1.4 billion people. We're talking about the ruling leadership and the, like, you know, Communist Party state. So, like, it's just a matter of trying to clearly distinguish. And then, you know, people will take it however they take it. Unfortunately, like, you know, like, on the internet, like, anybody can be outraged by anything.
And they do.
And you can't control that.
That was actually one of the things I was really happy to see in Australia, is that everyone, all the critical voices, were very clear themselves that to say we're talking about the Chinese Communist Party, not the Chinese people.
Yes, and I'm really glad that more and more kind of China experts and reporters are, like, just talking about this issue. I think a lot of people were clear about it, but like now it's like there people are like explicitly stating we need to like separate these two things. We need to be clear about what's happening. So that's very good, I think, and positive. But like it's interesting how that one topic can be so effective at dividing people.
Yeah, well, because, you know, people have experienced legitimate racism, and that's a sensitive issue. People don't want to be called racist, and it instantly makes people defensive. So just by throwing that out there, the conversation is totally derailed from what the original point was.
Yeah, even when I was, before I read Clive Hamilton's book, Silent Invasion, I had read a couple of reviews of it, and they made it seem like more extreme than it was. Like, they made it seem kind of like he was, you know, like advocating for, they didn't call him racist, but like they seemed to like take issue with the way he talked about the issue or like his like solutions that he proposed. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we read the book before, we both read the book before we interviewed him. What was your take on that? Did you feel that was at all accurate?
I mean, as soon as you read the introduction to the book, like he starts talking about how he's aware and like concerned about whether people would think he was racist, you know? And so like from the beginning, he's like trying to like forestall these types of attacks that he understands what's going to happen. But I was also kind of surprised to learn that Clive Hamilton is like a, like his politics are actually like far left. Like he's a member of the Greens Party.
Yeah. Which is a weird disconnect for people. 'Cause a lot of times they think critical of China, conservative.
Right. I mean, it is true that like a lot of the most critical voices from on China have been from